Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Katie Weaver, Brian Lynn, Bruce Albert, and Dan Friedel. Later, Anna Mateo will have this week's health and lifestyle report. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
British officials are dealing with international reaction to Britain's decision to leave the European Union. British Finance Minister George Osborne spoke publicly on Monday for the first time since the British vote last week. Osborne tried to calm financial markets. He said the British economy remains strong and that Britain remains open for business. He added that Britain's financial system was in a good position to support the country.
Britain's financial system will help our country deal with any shocks and dampen them, not contribute to those shocks or make them worse.
The vote to leave the EU has led to sharp drops in stock prices around the world. It also has fueled unrest on international currency exchanges. Britain's money, the pound, has decreased in value on currency exchanges around the world. The pound has dropped to its lowest level in 30 years. Monday, a weaker pound and euro helped push China's money, the yuan, to its lowest exchange value against the American dollar in more than 5 years. In Japan, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called for a cooperative effort among major economies to ease financial problems. To the Bank of Japan, he said, "I'd like to ask it to closely cooperate with central banks of the other G7 countries to take necessary steps for the economy and financial markets." Japanese officials and business leaders met Monday to discuss economic issues related to the British vote. Finance Minister Taro Aso appealed to other financial officials to watch currency markets closely. The Japanese yen has gained more than 15% in exchange value to the dollar since the beginning of the year. In Europe, French Finance Minister Michel Sapin called on Britain to move quickly to carry out plans to leave the European Union. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said any British withdrawal from the EU should be a civil and organized one. British officials say 72% of voters marked a ballot in the nationwide referendum. About 52% of Britons voted to leave the EU. The government must put in place Article 50 of the EU treaty in order to start an official exit, a process that could take up to 2 years. Overturning the referendum is still technically possible. The vote last week was a non-binding measure. The British government may or may not take action. However, experts say a second vote is unlikely. Leaders of the campaign to leave the EU are now facing strong criticism. Opponents of leaving say, for example, that Conservative politician Boris Johnson did not have a plan to deal with the political and financial unrest that has followed the vote. Johnson wrote in the Daily Telegraph newspaper that supporters of remaining in the EU have made too much of the vote's bad consequences. Prime Minister David Cameron announced plans to resign after the referendum. He said the country needed, in his words, fresh leadership to go in the direction of leaving Europe. Yet the referendum showed deep divisions in Britain. Scotland, Northern Ireland, and London all supported remaining in the EU, while other parts of the country supported leaving. In Scotland, First Minister Nicola Sturgeon said another popular vote on independence from Britain was now highly likely. I'm Mario Ritter.
Iraqi forces recaptured the city of Fallujah from Islamic State fighters after a month of fighting. On Sunday, Iraqi Lieutenant General Abdul Wahab al-Saadi called Fallujah fully liberated. He also said the next step would be to retake Mosul. The destruction in Fallujah is extensive. Almost 85,000 people fled Fallujah and nearby areas to escape the fighting. Many of the displaced are without shelter. The summer temperatures are 45 degrees Celsius or higher. Powerful sandstorms are also a danger. Many citizens of Fallujah took shelter at a health center near the city. It is lacking water supplies and human waste systems. Center Director Ahmed Basel said, "We have too many people. There are no more spaces in the camps. Every 5 meters, you find a family. Women and children make up most of the population at refugee camps in Iraq. Males over the age of 14 were separated from their families as they fled Fallujah. United Nations Refugee Agency workers met with Iraqi families. The UNHCR said those talks confirmed reports that almost all families are missing several family members. U.S.-led coalition airstrikes supported Iraqi forces in the battles for Fallujah. Shiite militias also assisted Iraqi forces on the ground. There are no clear reports of deaths and injuries on either side of the fighting. Iraqi officials warned civilians against returning to their homes, although conditions in the camps are bad. The officials said some parts of Fallujah are unsafe. There is concern that similar problems of displacement will take place in a battle for Mosul. Islamic State forces have occupied the city since June 2014. Its population is estimated at 2.5 million. Mosul is Iraq's second largest city. Aid agencies are worried that more Iraqis will lose their homes. Close to 600,000 Mosul area civilians may be displaced during the fight for the city. Those agencies told VOA The displacement will be a disaster many times the size of the current situation outside Fallujah. Iraqi Kurdish military commanders are saying that Mosul will be a more difficult fight than Fallujah. They say it will require a political-military agreement among all groups involved. For example, Kurdish commanders are warning against permitting Shiite militias to take part in the offensive in the Sunni-majority area. I'm Katie Weaver.
When U.S. congressional Democrats demanded votes on gun control measures last week, Republican leaders turned off the cameras. The action is strangely similar to what congressional Democrats did in 2008 to answer a Republican protest over energy legislation. But in 2016, Democratic Party lawmakers had a new way to get their protest message out. They used cameras on mobile telephones to provide live video of their speeches on social media. That technology was not available in 2008. So Americans could watch as Congressman John Lewis, a leader of the civil rights movement in the 1960s, spoke about the cost of gun violence. Lewis said that guns kill 30,000 people across the country each year. "We have lost too many of our children, our babies," he said. "We have lost too many of our mothers and fathers." The Georgia congressman and other Democratic lawmakers took turns speaking for nearly 26 hours straight in the House of Representatives. Many held up pictures of people killed by guns. Much of their focus was on the 49 people killed earlier this month at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. It was the largest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Since the Orlando shootings, congressional Democrats have stepped up efforts to pass gun control legislation. At the top of their list are bills to expand background checks. Supporters say such bills, when enacted, would stop people with a criminal record or who support terrorism from buying guns. The Democrats also want to ban the military-style weapons used in the Orlando attack and other recent mass shootings. They include the one last December in San Bernardino, California, the mass killing at a Connecticut elementary school in 2012, and the attack at a Colorado movie theater. The Republican Party holds majorities in both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Republican lawmakers generally support the position of the National Rifle Association. The NRA argues against bills that would limit what the group says is a constitutional right to own guns. "Terrorism is the issue, and defeating terrorism is our focus here in the House," said House Speaker Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. "Let me be really clear. We are not going to take away the constitutional rights of law-abiding Americans." Ryan called the Democratic protest a political ploy. Mark Morial is president of the National Urban League. He has supported gun control laws since the 1990s when he was mayor of New Orleans, Louisiana. He was the first mayor to take legal action against gun manufacturers for deaths and injuries on the streets of New Orleans, but the case failed. Morial told VOA he is not surprised gun control bills continue to face strong opposition. "It reflects the power of the NRA," he said. "It is also due to a strong gun culture among many Americans who enjoy hunting and want guns for self-protection," Morial said. Just hours after the House of Representatives protest ended Thursday, the Senate took up a gun control bill written by Maine Senator Susan Collins, a Republican, with moderate Democrats and Republicans. By a 52-46 vote, the Senate agreed to let her bill move forward, but that was still 8 votes short of what Collins needs for Senate passage. Her bill would block gun sales to individuals on U.S. government no-fly list because of their suspected links to terrorists. Also stopped from buying guns would be people required to go through additional airport screening because of security concerns. Her bill would permit court hearings for those denied the chance to buy guns. The National Rifle Association's Chris Cox said the Collins bill does not do enough to protect gun rights. Unfortunately, Senator Collins and others are focusing their efforts on unconstitutional proposals that would not have prevented the Orlando terrorist attack, he said. He added that Congress should focus on fighting terrorism. Shannon Frateroli is a professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy. He said most of the 30,000 gun violence victims killed each year are not killed by terrorists, but by people they know. Catholic University political science professor Matthew Green said all the attention paid to congressional Democrats last week was unusual. Usually, the leaders of the majority party and the news media ignore the minority party, Green said. But he said all the attention to the Democratic protest probably will not be enough to pass a single gun control bill this year. I'm Bruce Alpert.
The United Nations is continuing to build legal cases against North Korea's leadership for crimes against humanity. UN officials are gathering statements and other evidence from more than 30,000 North Korean defectors to support the cases. Human rights activists and UN representatives met in Seoul on Monday to discuss the latest developments in the investigation. Sinye Polson represents the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Seoul. She said the investigation is continuing, but it takes time and is hard to prepare a case based on information from defectors alone. The investigators are trying to collect evidence linking North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and other high-level officials to crimes against humanity. In 2014, a UN commission of inquiry called on the UN to refer North Korea's leadership to the International Criminal Court. The inquiry report documented at least 120,000 political prisoners inside the country. It also linked North Korean officials to atrocities including extermination, murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, rape, forced abortions, and other sexual violence. The UN General Assembly voted in support of the Commission of Inquiry's call for action. But the measure was never passed in the Security Council, where North Korea's allies China and Russia would likely veto it. The Security Council ordered new sanctions on North Korea earlier this year for carrying out a nuclear test and launching a long-range rocket. Those measures are not directly linked to the international concerns about the country's human rights record. Marzuki Darusman is the UN Special Rapporteur on North Korea. He said UN officials and human rights groups continue to build legal cases against North Korean officials. But he said those cases may never be brought unless the government of Kim Jong-un collapses someday. UN investigators believe Kim should ultimately be held responsible for the atrocities committed in North Korea. They say they have found orders and handwritten notes directly connecting him to some crimes. Greg Scarlatou, with Human Rights North Korea, said low-level officials in state security agencies also should be held responsible. But North Korea expert Remco Breuker from Leiden University in the Netherlands disagrees. UN officials and activists working to build a case against the North Korean leadership know that no legal action is likely to happen anytime soon. But they remain hopeful that one day the political environment will change to make prosecutions possible. I'm Brian Lynn.
When athletes from around the world march in the opening ceremony of the 2016 Olympic Games, one team will walk into the stadium without a country flag. The team will be carrying the Olympic flag instead. They are the team of refugees. The International Olympic Committee announced in March that it would sponsor the first ever Olympic refugee team. It named 10 athletes to the team in June. The athletes are from Syria, South Sudan, Ethiopia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. They will compete in the swimming, running, and judo events at the Olympic Games, which start on August 5th in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The IOC says it hopes the 10 athletes can be a symbol of hope for refugees worldwide, as well as a reminder of the refugee crisis. 5 of the refugee Olympic athletes are runners from South Sudan. They are training in Kenya. Rose Natike Lonkonyen is one of the team members. She was just 4 years old when her family left South Sudan. Now she is 23. She and her family lived at a refugee camp in Kenya for 16 years. She says she was determined to participate in sports from a young age. She remembers her father punishing her for playing soccer. She says, "He was just looking after me." Lokonyen thinks about her family often. She had to leave her younger brothers at the refugee camp in order to train for the Olympics. Lokonyen trains with 4 other runners from South Sudan at a training center named after Tegla Lerupe, a famous Kenyan runner. She competed in the marathon and the 10,000-meter races at many Olympics and world championships. Lokonyen runs for about 2 hours each day to train for the Olympics. She will compete in the 800-meter race in Rio. Jackson Kemboi is the manager of the training camp in Kenya. He says he is hopeful about the athletes' chances in Rio. He describes them as disciplined, and that is what's needed most. A recent story from the New York Times called "The Runners from South Sudan Promising but Untested in Top Competition." I'm Dan Friedel.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. We all know that exercise keeps us healthy. But two new studies get more specific. They look at how exercise may lower the risk of two major causes of death, cancer and stroke. One study says exercise may lower the risk for 13 types of cancer. Another says that middle-aged people can reduce their chance of having a stroke by exercising. First, let's talk about cancer. Stephen Moore of the National Cancer Institute led a team of researchers to study more than 1.4 million people. The study looked at participants in 12 U.S. and European groups. These people reported on their physical activity between 1987 and 2004. The researchers looked at the occurrence of 26 kinds of cancer among the participants during, on average, the next 11 years. Many participants reported walking, running, and swimming. The researchers took into account how long they exercised per week, what they ate, if they were obese, and if they smoked. In an interview with NBC News, Moore explains that exercise can help people reduce their risk of heart disease. It can reduce the risk of diabetes. It helps you live longer. And now, he adds, it appears that it may reduce the risks of some cancers. Moore and his team found that exercise lowered the risk of developing cancer of the esophagus by 42%, liver cancer by 27%, lung cancer by 26%, and breast cancer by 10%. Exercise also lowered the risk of a specific type of leukemia by 20%. Moore told NBC that there are some possible explanations for the findings. First, exercise can lower hormone levels like estrogen. Lower levels of estrogen would lower the risk of breast and endometrial cancers. He adds that exercise helps maintain insulin, and that may lower overall inflammation in the body. However, one type of cancer puzzled the researchers. They found that exercise increased the chance of developing prostate cancer by 5%, but they wrote that they could not explain the connection. The researchers also found that people who did heavier exercises had a slightly higher rate of skin cancer. This, they say, could be from more sun exposure. Now, how exercise affects strokes. The more fit a person is in middle age, the less likely he or she will have a crippling stroke after age 65. This is the result of a new study by the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. Doctors studied 20,000 men and women between the ages of 45 and 50. They found that those who were most fit from moderate to vigorous exercise had a 37% lower risk of a stroke than those who were least fit. They say the lowered risk of a future stroke was present even when the subjects had other risk factors. These factors include high blood pressure and type 2 diabetes. The researchers of this study say they want doctors to not ignore low levels of exercise and fitness as risk factors for a stroke. This study was published in the latest issue of the medical journal called Stroke. I'm Anna Mateo.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.